Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's News Talk Leader.
Good morning to you, 909 on KDXU. I'm Andy Griffin. Thanks for tuning in today. We have Dr. David Blodgett with us today. He is the guy that's been around the world and back. I'm glad you're back.
Yeah.
Former chief resident at Johns Hopkins University, currently the... I always forget your official title. What are you?
The official title is health officer.
Officer for the Southwest Utah Public Health Department, which covers the five counties here in Southern Utah.
They even give you a badge.
You have a badge. Like you're an officer.
Like officer badge.
Can you give anybody a ticket?
I don't think so, but apparently it's if I have to go on scene, you know, I can flash my badge. I've never actually done it, but apparently it's an option.
Okay. Now, have you ever been in a situation when... someone say, is there a doctor in the house? Have you ever been the guy? Yeah, I'm a doctor, and you help someone?
Yeah,
have.
I've done that before too. And
really?
The further I get away from medical school and the clinical side of things, you know, I tend to not have the latest on that, so I'm less likely to want to do that.
So, Dr. Blodgett, do one of those, what do they call those, where they put the hole in the throat so they can breathe, and you're like, I don't really want to stab that dude. It's been a while, you know.
It's been a while. It's true.
Yeah.
It's true, but I probably still could.
You could. It's like riding a bicycle,
right?
If there's
somebody else there, I'll let them do it.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I always, the joke about, is there a doctor in the house, and the guy says, yeah, I got my PhD, you know. In geology or something, you know.
And they still think they can do it.
Yeah. Or there's that famous Seinfeld episode where George was a marine biologist. He really wasn't, but and he went out. Steve was angry that day, my friend. Anyway, yeah.
That's right.
So,
I remember that one.
I watch way too much old sitcoms on syndication.
Sometimes there's some good there.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Dr. Blodgett is here, and we're going to talk about a couple of different topics. One of them I know a little about, but he knows more. Another one I know very little about, and he knows more. So that's why you're here. You're the expert, and I'm the guy that will interview the expert. So are you okay with that?
No, that's good. I'm just glad to see you're healthy again. Last time I missed because you had stuff going on, so I'm glad you're feeling better.
I'm okay. I mean, I played pickleball last time. We played for an hour and a half. It was nice. And in fact, the people we played with wanted to postpone until Thursday because it was a rainy day yesterday. But by the time we played in the, you know, 7:30 last night, the you know, rain had dried up. The courts were actually dry.
Cool.
And was able to get out and about. And I learned from Dr. Blodgett. That's one of the keys, is to be active and move around and
absolutely.
Do stuff. So
absolutely.
And that actually segues us right into what's going on right now with type 2 diabetes. I know you've told me these numbers before, but I was like, again, kind of like, wow, really? One in three Americans are pretty much type 2 pre-diabetes?
Yeah, if you include what they call metabolic syndrome, which is your blood pressure's inching up, your waistline's getting a little bigger, your blood sugars are kind of inching up. Probably true pre-diabetes is probably more in the kind of 25% range.
That's still a lot.
But still a lot of people, and we're at about 1 in 10 Americans now have diabetes, which is staggering because it adds tremendously to the burden of disease for somebody's life, for the costs of health care.
Yeah.
The projections are that 2050, which isn't as far away as you think it is, about half of all the expenditures on health care would be related to diabetes. It's a staggering problem and something that is facing really all of us. I mean, there's not the age range where you start to see that 35-40% pre-diabetes is in the elderly once you get above 65.
Okay.
And then there's this other statistic, which is about
This is the one we don't want to hear, right?
Yeah. If you go about 10 years after somebody's diagnosed with prediabetes, and half of them will be diabetic. So
now talk about what that means, being diabetic, because I think a lot of people hear prediabetes, okay, I'm a little overweight, so what? But when you actually become diabetic, that's when things really bad start happening to your body.
Right. So your body isn't processing sugars. Mm. The sugars that you eat in your diet, it turns out you need sugars, right? That's what your brain survives on. It's part of the survival mechanism. But we also have a very tightly controlled band of where your sugar levels are appropriate to you. And so too high of sugars, it turns out, does a lot of really bad things to you. Sugars are a very potent oxidant.
Okay. When
we talk about antioxidants and oxidants, sugar itself is a very potent oxidant, and so it, well, when I speak on diabetes, I use the quip of, well, so which systems are influenced by diabetes? And the answer is only the ones that have blood that are part of them. So everything.
Pretty much all of them.
There's nothing in your body that isn't impacted by diabetes. So you look at any system in your body, and being a diabetic impacts that, right? So the small blood vessels in your eyes can go bad. So it's one of the leading causes of blindness. The blood vessels in your kidneys can be impacted. So it's one of the leading causes of kidney failure. The little blood vessels in your feet can be impacted. So it's one of the leading causes of amputation, things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't name any part of your body that isn't negatively impacted by diabetes. The heart increases heart attacks, heart disease, all of that kind of stuff. Strokes. There really isn't any part of your body that isn't negatively impacted by too much sugars happening in your body. And of course, you can have events where the blood sugar gets so high that you can't even function, right? You can go into a coma and die. And
diabetes.
This range of things that can happen, and most of us don't know it. You don't feel it. You don't feel you have high blood sugar. You just do. So
type 1 and type 2 are obviously, the way you get them is very different. And type 1 was the original, you know, my cousin, I remember when I was a little kid, had type 1 diabetes. I didn't know anybody else with diabetes. I mean, it was rare. Now I know, I can count five people I know who have type 2 diabetes. Sure. So even though they're very different in the way you get them, what happens to your body is actually very much the same, right?
Right. Yeah, it was rare enough. It's before my time, but most of my preceptors in medical school said, you know, when we would have a diabetic come in, it was a call everybody together. We all go take a look at them because it was rare. You do that for rare things. And diabetes was so rare that if a diabetic came in, the whole hospital would go take a look and see what was going on. And by the time I came along, it was half the people in the hospital, you know, so it wasn't a big deal like that. So it's definitely a phenomenon that has exploded in our modern society. And it parallels closely with, the explosion of overweight, obesity, you know, those kinds of things. And exercise trends have decreased. We have less work to do to get our work done because we all sit behind a screen or we drive all day or whatever, and we don't get the exercise, things like that. But
my cousin, with his type 1 diabetes, he was sickly from a very early age, and that, it's sad, but I can't describe him any better way than to say he was a sickly guy. Right. He was always sick. He did not grow as much as his brother, so it seemed like his growth was stunted a little bit. He actually passed away in his 30s from heart problems. Really a profile of what type 1 diabetes was, but now type 2 diabetes is becoming. How early does type 2, can kids get type 2 diabetes?
So type 1 is actually an autoimmune disease. Your body turns on itself and destroys your pancreas, so you don't produce insulin anymore.
Wow.
And so very different profile than in type 2. You build up resistance to insulin, and so you might actually be producing tons and tons of insulin, but your body just doesn't use it properly because your cells are not sensitive to it, things like that. And eventually kind of burn out the pancreas and it stops producing, but it's a different mechanism. So a lot of times we used to actually call it juvenile diabetes because it would happen in kids, and that was type 1.
Yeah.
Type 2, but that number has been decreasing.
Oh, you know, it's so, going down.
So there's now, you know, the rates of obesity in kids in elementary school has gone up to 20%, 25%, 30%, you know, and so we're starting to see type 2 diabetics as young as 10 or 11 years old kind of thing, you know.
Wow.
And it just has to do with that you have to maintain that sensitivity to insulin, which is, it's all about exercise, eating right, you know, all those things we want, everybody wants to talk about so much.
So my kids, you know, watching them grow up, they were pretty skinny as little kids, and then they got a little chunky, a little chubby at 10, 11, 12, right up to about 14. And then once they hit high school, they started to grow more, and they got, and they were more active, obviously, but, and then they got thin again and became relatively thin adults. So to me, I'm like, well, that's just normal, right? Little baby fat, that's normal, isn't it?
Little bit. There's normal, though, and then there's extra, right? And I think you kind of, people most know the difference between that. And it's interesting because just being a fat kid doesn't mean you're going to be, I shouldn't say it that way, but being overweight as a child doesn't mean you're going to be overweight as an adult.
Right.
But it is predictive, right? Something like two-thirds of kids that are in that overweight category when they're kids end up being overweight as an adult. And there's impacts emotionally and socially and psychologically that happen, you know, from all of that. It's just a,
For sure.
It's a tough conundrum. And so now we throw some interesting things in there with the new medications for, you know, obesity. And
that's true.
I think the implications are, I don't think we know all of the implications, but the dynamics are changing rapidly, and it's something that I'm trying to figure out. Does this mean it's the end of obesity as an epidemic? I don't know. Can we put everybody in the country on
probably not until the prices go down.
Exactly. I don't know. And is that good? You know, the side effect profile is severe enough that probably a third to 40% or so stop taking it
because
they can't handle it. And so,
especially the when you very first get on it, you know, you're getting nausea and all. I mean, right. It hits hard.
They try and decrease the dose, but then maybe it doesn't work. And as soon as you go off it, you shoot right back up. And right. There's just... The whole dynamics of obesity and diabetes even has begun to change with these new medications, and I think we need some time to work out some of the dynamics here. But
so I was going to ask you about that. So some of these drugs were originally for diabetics, basically.
They were designed.
So they have been around a while. Some of them, right?
Well, there's an older class of GLP-1 agonists that were around.
Okay.
But the newer ones are much more effective. They bind better and they just work better. So Ozempic is, you know, 2 or 3 years old now, but it's just much more effective than the old ones were. So you could see about a 10% weight loss with the old ones. Ozempic is in that kind of 20, 25%.
Right.
Mounjaro, which has got two agonists in it, it'll get you in the 30, 35.
That's like the Cadillac one, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it also costs more than all the others.
It does, but there's all these things that get highlighted when something like this comes out. Like, you know, if you have insurance, you do better. Does insurance pay it? No. Yes. Is Medicare and Medicaid going to come into this? You learn how complex and really how crazy the system is when you start to try and figure out how you navigate all this, you
seriously.
Know, to get something that you really could use and need. I used to think I knew some answers in this space, but the longer it goes, the more I'm realizing this is, and some doctors are calling it the miracle, you know, that we needed. Others are like, oh, no, this is not going to be great. And I think the answer is somewhere in the middle. It'll have a good part in what we need to be doing. But there's still, in all of this, is a role for healthier eating and diet and paying attention to your health overall.
Right. So I think the prevalent thinking right now is they're charging so much for these drugs. They're not that expensive to make, but they're charging so much because it may cost these, you know, big pharma a lot of money down the road, because then they're not prescribing as much, you know, statins or whatever for high blood pressure and cholesterol and things like that. Is that flawed thinking, or is that true, do you think?
It may be, but I think they just want to make as much money as they can before it goes off patent. That's just the way it works, you know. So, yeah, they actually did a study on how much it would cost to actually make Ozempic, for example. It's pennies, you know.
Oh,
so,
man. And it costs, what, $1,000 a month or something?
Yeah, it's $1,100, $1,200 a month. Man. I did see they had a plan recently. They came out and said, well, if you pay cash, then we'll do it for $500 a month. So so things will come down. I mean, the question is, do you stick people on it and leave them there for the rest of their life, you know? And so after a year, it plateaus. You lose what you're going to lose, and then it just flattens out, right? The question is, maybe are you going to still... The body's really good at combating whatever you throw at it, you know, if you don't do it, you know, in a way that works for your body. And
tachyphylaxis,
so,
maybe.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah,
I remember that word.
I'm giving you some words. And in this case, the body really has an energy drive to maintain energy for times of less abundance, right? And so when it perceives that it's not getting what it needs, it develops ways to overcome that. And that's why it's so difficult to fast and lose weight very quickly, and have why ramping down slowly over time, that month, that pound or two a month over, you know, an extended period of time is the way to have your body be okay with what's going on. And so I think we need to be a little more sophisticated in our approach to some of this stuff, and little, you know, see some things, you understand some things a little better. But there, it is definitely a different day in the world to talk as we talk about obesity and what the solutions are. It's really the first time we've had something that works, and that's it's exciting. So
if we go back to type 2 diabetes, Dave said something earlier. Dave Heaton, and then Dr. Dave Blodgett is here, but he said a lot of people don't want to know if they're pre-diabetic, because that means that they would have to change some things in their life, and they don't want to change things. But, you know, I've found with a lot of problems, and you can address this a little bit, just because we don't know about it doesn't mean it goes away.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, the head in the sand approach is really a good idea. But so we run these events, and that's what's going on right now. And I'm sure that's why Dave talked about it, where we say we're willing to give you, come in, take a brief screening questionnaire, and then if you fit the risk profile that you might be at risk, then we'll give you a free A1C this month, right?
So
we try and save up some money, and we pull some money together, and we offer free A1Cs. And we always think, oh man, we should have, you know, 1,000 people come and do this. And we always end up with, you know, 30 or something.
Oh,
like that.
Wow, really?
And so even when people come into the clinic to get, you know, something else from us, they'll say, hey, how about a free A1C, or take this test? And everybody says, don't want to know. I'm good. And you're like, it's so much harder to deal with disease once it's cemented itself in than to stop it, right? So we talked about pre-diabetes going to diabetes. If you get it when it's pre-diabetic, and you lose, here's an example, you lose 5 to 7% of your body weight. It doesn't have to be all of it. You don't have to become super skinny or anything like that.
So if you're 200 pounds, if you lose 10 pounds.
Right.
10 to 14 pounds.
Your likelihood of progressing from pre-diabetes to diabetes goes down by 65-70%.
Wow.
And so it becomes, which the lifestyle change you have to make for that is much different than diabetes, right? So now sugars are off the table. You can't, you know, it's a total invasion of every part of your life, right?
Yeah.
And so it makes it so much better to find out it's a problem or could be a problem before it really is the big problem that diabetes is. And because we know so much more about it, and we're so much better at giving better advice, and we know how to intervene in that pre-diabetic stage, it's so much better if you know. But But I get it. Everybody has the ability to choose, and they do. But I'm just telling you, it's going to be better to do it this way than that way.
And people are going, yeah, but I'm not giving up my Coke, or I'm not giving up my Twinkie, or whatever it is. Right. And just like you could talk to, and by the way, I saw numbers for smoking is down, but if you tell a smoker, someone who's really, you know, smokes a lot, hey, that's going to kill you, they kind of get mad at you and they don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
You're going to get lung cancer or lip cancer or throat cancer, yeah, or whatever, and they don't want to hear it.
Well, and I think smoking's different at this point. I don't think anybody in America doesn't know that smoking is really bad for you.
It's on the side of the package. It will kill you.
Well, it's not just that. It's just, I just think the messaging is inundated, society. But in that case, we have to acknowledge and recognize that people have the right to make those kinds of decisions. You know, they can do that. The force method, you know, just doesn't work. And so you try and tell, you try and help people, you try and give them options and make recommendations, but in the end it still comes down to what am I as a person willing to do. And so we've tried to get, and I've talked about this before, but I think it's really an important point. We've tried to figure out how do we get people to that aha moment where it dawns on them, hey, they're not just talking about everybody else, they're talking about me.
Right? Yeah.
This is something that can kill me. This is something that could be a real problem in my life. This is something that could, you know, interfere with my social life, my relationships, my, you know, ability to get along and live a healthy life. That they're not talking about everybody else, they're talking about me, and I personally need to do something about it, or I'm going to end up like what they're talking about. And wow, making that translation from, oh, yeah, I've heard that, you know, it's bad to have diabetes, diabetes is a bad disease, you know, lots of people have it, but, oh, they're talking about me. That translation is what we've never figured out how to do. And
I know exactly what you're talking about. I really do.
If I could figure it out, then I could be wealthy, but I'm not. I haven't. So here we are just trying to encourage people to learn about it, to take it in and apply it to themselves, and to realize we're not trying to be mean. We're trying to help you live a better, longer, happier life.
Trying to translate it somehow so it actually clicks somewhere in there in the brain. So, all right, got to get a weather break in. We're on with Dr. David Blodgett today from the Southwest Utah Public Health Department. By the way, if you want to call, 673-5890 is the phone number. You can text me at 43. Actually, I have a couple of texts I'll have to look at here in a minute. 435-467-5842 is my text number. We'll be right back.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports, just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Our monthly visit, we missed it last month. I was under the weather, and Dr. Blodgett, he was very nice, very gracious about taking the month off, but we missed you, Dr. Blodgett.
Well, I missed you.
We missed you, being here on the air and advising us. All right, I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about what they call the autism spectrum. You know, I guess before, now I have a couple of grandkids that are on the spectrum, as they say. I don't even know really what that means necessarily, but, you know, my daughter-in-law tells me that they're mildly autistic, and I'm like, well, you know, what does that mean? And how does that fit in with the all too common ADHD, or just attention deficit disorder, ADD? And I don't know. And so I was hoping maybe you could kind of shed a little bit. Well, a couple of numbers I saw were pretty stunning. 1 in 31 kids in the U.S. are autistic or on the spectrum. That's like 3%. That's a pretty big number.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's some. It's hard to know what we're talking about definition-wise, right? So we have all these charts in public health where you go along and they're using one definition to define something, and then they change the definition and it shoots up or it goes down, you know, and so you have to have a pre this definition number and after, and so some of this is that we're just better at defining what autism is
So maybe the numbers were actually fairly high before. We just didn't recognize
it. Or higher than we think they might have been. And I think really what would happen is if they were fairly severely autistic, that was pretty obvious.
Right.
But if they're just a little off and they're just kind of
socially awkward.
You know, socially awkward. You didn't equate that with something like autism. You just said he's just kind of a quirky guy, you know? And so, that part of it, I don't think we have a really good feel for. I do, however, think we're seeing more autism than there has been in the past. It's just a question of the scope and the magnitude that I think we don't really have a good feel for. Because, you know, I remember in school we had kids that everybody knew they were
a little different.
They were, you know, we had a kid that would run out and touch the net on the basketball hoop and everybody'd cheer, right? We just knew he was off. We didn't quite know exactly why. And now we're getting better in defining our terms and, you know, they have testing now where they can find precursor things to autism in the womb, right? And so as we have this debate about, well, what causes autism, and we try and move it towards productive directions, all of the science and everything we can figure out is it happens from either genetic, there's a genetic predisposition there, and, you know, just about 30% of most diseases is related to some sort of genetic component. Sure. And exposures in the womb, right? So, ironically enough, given the debate about other things, fever, a maternal fever that's really high, such as you would have with flu or something like that,
right,
turns out to be one of those factors that they're zeroing in on that probably
has something. So mom gets sick.
Yeah. And you get a fever for the baby, which makes sense, right? You're developing brain tissues, you're organizing all those neurons and everything, and then you get a hyperheat event, and that could cause trouble. But nutritional status probably will have something to do with it. Exposure to certain chemicals, which, you know, I think they're doing an extensive look at that. But, you know, the science behind autism has been put back by 30, 40, 50 years by the debate over vaccines and autism. And so getting to the real causes of autism is something they're finally really starting to do, which is good, right? And so the studies are starting to come out. And what is clear is, even in newborn babies, you can pick up the signs
already
of something going on in the brain that is leading to the autistic spectrum. And so, something that happened in the womb is where it's coming down to. But boy, you know, there's still work to be done to figure out exactly what the mechanisms are there and if there's something that can be done about that, you know.
So, let me ask you about a couple of the terms they use. First of all, the spectrum, the autism spectrum. Does that just mean how autistic they are? It's a scale? And is there different things that make it, you know, I mean, you were talking about the causes. If someone's severe autism spectrum, we don't know necessarily why, except for maybe something that happened.
Right. I think that's some of the stuff that needs to be done with this research is figure out, well, what are the determining factors? And almost everything when you hear a spectrum means it's probably not one condition, but many, right?
Yeah, that's what I think.
And it probably also means it's multifactorial, meaning there's lots of different things that can contribute to it, and you get three or four different ones that hit you, and that's worse, you know. And so it's not going to be as simple as, oh, this was it, this is the one thing, and because anytime you see a variation like that, it means it's probably very complex. And so cancer is a good example of that, right? Cancer is not one.
Yeah, you say cancer, there's a whole bunch of different kinds.
Thousands of diseases, right? Yeah. And so finding the cure for cancer is not just as easy as thing. It's going to be a very multi-factor, multidisciplinary approach. And I think that that autism is in that realm of we've clumped it all together into one thing, but it's not. It's going to be many things and other factors that contributed to it all being varied, and it's that complexity that will, once we start to unravel that, that will allow us to do something about it, but it will also be, it'll make it difficult. It's a difficult issue to approach.
Another word they like to use a lot is a word called neurodivergent. Neurodivergent. What does that mean to you?
Well, divergent means different. Different. Right? Okay. So, yeah.
So their brain is different.
They have parts, the interactive parts of the brain, the parts that allow us to read facial expressions and to synthesize all that information that's coming in at the same time and process it into a response that, you know, meets all of these variables about expectations and everything else, it's incredibly, when you think about what the brain's doing at any given moment life, and to have just a little bit of difference in that processing capacity in the brain can create a lot of difference in how people respond to that. And so this ability to synthesize and read and understand the world around you and then interact appropriately with that, incredibly complex, and trying to unravel that to figure out where those things break down is part of what this autism research will be about.
Because autism is so, as you mentioned, it is probably several different things. It's not one thing necessarily. Is it possible that everyone has a little kind Could of be. Autism in them?
Well, we all have a little bit of quirkiness about
us,
right?
Yeah,
So. What is it that helps make up that variation, the spice of life? You know, there's genetic variation in all of us, and I don't know. I think that's possible. We all have a little bit of some of this in us, you know, and it certainly is what makes us all unique and variable and different and appealing to each other. And you know, if we were all the same person, it'd be just a very different world.
Very boring. So. I was reading, somebody said every person with autism has a different kind of autism or something like that. I'm like, well, yeah, because everybody is right. We're completely all different.
And it doesn't mean it doesn't have common underlying factors,
right?
At some, you know, on some level, but I mean, that's why they call it practicing medicine, right?
Yes,
because
exactly.
Everybody's just a little bit different, and you never get it exactly right because somebody else comes in that they just respond differently than anybody else you've ever seen. So,
are there some treatments or some things that are working with people who have medium to severe autism? Are things working?
I think we're doing better with autism than we've ever done. The behavioral interventions are much better.
Behavioral. Okay.
Yeah, when you know what you're dealing with and you can help people process with that, and families know how to help process with that. There's the range of medications that can help with symptoms or parts of that are improving over time. So it's getting better than it ever has been, but I think there's still a lot of work to be done.
All right. We need another commercial break. Let's answer this text before we go to commercial break. He said, my latest blood work indicates pre-diabetes. Doctor said I can control with my diet or go on meds. I want to stay off meds, so what can I do diet-wise? I'm trying to eliminate sugar drinks first, and that's probably a really good place to start, right?
Yeah, it is a great place to start. The maxim in the nutrition field is, if you want to lose weight, the best place to start is not drinking your calories, right? So cutting out, so it turns out nutrition packed into drinks is, it tends to be bad nutrition because it doesn't have any other value to you besides, you know, adding calories. And it also, it's calories straight to the bottom line. I think though your doctor missed one aspect of this, and that is exercise, because exercise does two things. One, it burns calories, but two, it also increases your sensitivity to insulin. And so I would never have a prescription for somebody that's pre-diabetic that doesn't include exercise as part of movement. That. And so, and it doesn't have to, we're not talking strenuous big time exercise. We're talking 20, 30 minutes of walking a day, you know, and so I'm doing a lot of speaking about this these days. And the thing I always chide people about is you watch people at Walmart and they circle the parking lot for hours trying to find that spot that's right in front of Walmart.
Right. Right.
And yet you've got, you park at the back of the parking lot and then you've got some walking time in there.
Yeah.
Right? So
yeah.
Those are the kind of things, being a little more intentional about adding some exercise that really can make a difference here. So part of it is diet. And we always say, if you can add another fruit or vegetable into your diet every day instead of something else, that's the way to go. Being thoughtful about it. I'm becoming more and more a believer in cutting out that bedtime snack before you go to bed.
Mm.
Turns out that just ends up sitting in your gut. Takes up a lot of metabolic energy to digest it. You end up seeing that end up in your waistline, but it doesn't really provide much to your overall well-being. And so, so something to think about is, so increase your fruits and vegetables, but also timing of food is turning out to be important, and exercise really, really critical as we look at this.
I was reading in a fitness book, this was back when I was in college, but I remember it made the statement, no amount of exercise can compensate for a bad diet. And I was thinking, we could probably turn that around, and no amount of good dieting can compensate for no exercise.
Yeah.
Same deal.
So let me add one factor in there.
Okay.
Cause so you know where I'm going on this, right?
Yeah, I do.
And that is sleep. Is critical to this. And a new study came out, and I'm going to use this in all my presentations now. This, what the study showed was that if you look at exercise and sleep together, something actually pretty shocking happens. The benefit for glucose sensitivity, for prediabetes and stuff like that with exercise evaporates if you're not sleeping 7 hours a night. It's crazy, right? So the curve is you actually do worse with your blood, your glucose sensitivity levels, the more you exercise, because you don't have that ability to recoup what you're doing. And so the J curve is alive and well, but it's worse if you're not sleeping. So
you could almost say no amount of good exercise and good diet can compensate for not getting enough sleep.
Yeah. Exactly. And okay. I know I'm becoming a broken record, but the more I delve into this area of sleep and how important it is for us, the more I realize you cannot be long-term healthy if you're not sleeping. It's just almost impossible. And so it's going to be a key part of what I do, and you'll see it out of what's coming out of the health department. Is sleep is where it's at.
You've
got to sleep.
And paying the bills too. We've got to play a commercial. We'll be right back.
That's true.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's News Talk Leader.
Down to the last couple of minutes here on the show. Real quick, somebody texted about ITIS. I don't know if it's ITIS or what it is, but you actually looked it up. It's comparable to food coma?
Yeah, it's postprandial. You know, you eat something and then you feel tired after that. So I wonder if they're wondering about, well, that's what helps me go to sleep.
Yeah.
Is I eat and then I, you know, go to sleep. And so I think that's something to consider, but I really think, and in the context of how do you lose weight and stuff like that, I think it's really difficult to lose weight if you're eating right before you go to bed. I think that's something that people that cut that out find that's really a bonus for them. And it's really the bedrock of, you hear a lot of people talking about intermittent fasting and things like that, and that's, I think ultimately the benefit is you're not loading your system up with a bunch of food that it doesn't have any way to, and it has to process that when it's supposed to be doing other things while you're sleeping.
Yeah.
And it really creates, it mucks up the system. So.
Well, I was thinking too, you just counseled us to get enough sleep. If we go to bed on time, for instance, I get up before 5. If I go to bed before 10, that would be my 7 hours. Right. And probably not going to be hungry yet when I go to bed. So it's all tied together a little bit.
It all comes together in the end, I guess. That's great.
All right, you got a couple of things. First of all, we want to remind everybody, right now you can go to the Southwest Utah Public Health Department website and take the little pre-screening test. Right. And then if it's determined that you are at risk, you can go get a free A1C pre-diabetes test and find out if you are, in fact, pre-diabetic.
Yeah, or even just come in and talk to our nurses, our clinical staff, and they will they'll do that pre-screening with you. And if you score high on that test or high enough, we'll give you a free A1C right now.
And it doesn't involve a giant needle, a little teeny one to prick your finger at all.
Yeah, it's just a finger poke.
But it might
help you avoid a whole bunch of finger pokes in the future. Right?
Yeah, that's true. And then you had, I was surprised maybe a little bit to learn this, but Utah was named what?
So we are the healthiest state in the nation.
Really?
The second year in a row, yep. We have considerably lower obesity rates than the rest of the country, and lower preventable hospitalization rates. So the only area where we don't rank better than the rest of the country is in air quality along the Wasatch Front. We still have pretty good air quality.
The inversion.
But that's the only area that we got flagged for in Utah. So a lot of it actually comes down to lower smoking rates, which we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
So some of those big ones we avoid here in Utah. So.
Yeah, we don't. And by the way, I started to say it earlier, but I think the U.S. is down to, isn't it close to 5% now of people smoke when it was up over 10 long ago?
Well, we're still at, depending on the survey, I think we're still at about 10%.
Okay, still too many. Not in Utah, though, I can tell you that. And the other problem with that is, smoking is going down, but unfortunately vaping is not going down. And that's not as dangerous as smoking, but it still is dangerous.
And now we've complicated the issue because it's not just vaping, but it's 1,000 other products that contain nicotine in it, right?
So,
you know, Zyn and all those stuff, people will find a way. But you know, the question is, do you want that to be part of who you are and to control your life or not. The other thing is our magazine is out. It should hit your mailbox soon, our latest issue of the magazine. It's kind of on a cartoon theme, which is kind of fun.
Yeah. But, is there a cartoon version of David Blodgett?
Yeah. No, I think I don't think they did that. But but the rest of it is all cartoon theme, so it's kind of fun.
All right. He's Dr. David Blodgett here every first Wednesday of the month. Thank you, Doctor, for coming in. Really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.
We're out of time. Back tomorrow, Nanette Billings will be joining me from Hurricane City on the program. Thanks for listening.